listening to WLXU 93.9 LPFM, Lexington Community Radio. My name is Chuck, and you're listening to Bluegrass Bios, as you are every week during this time from noon to 2 p.m. My name is Chuck, and with us in the studio, we have a special guest. Would you like to introduce yourself?
My name is Tom Trolland, and I'm from the University of Kentucky Department of Physics and Astronomy. I am an astronomer, and for much of my life, I've been tracking eclipses. I've seen a few of them and missed a few owing to bad weather, but I'm hoping for the best coming up on Monday.
That's awesome. And, you know, and particularly being here in Kentucky, you know, we're in a special spot for this one, right?
That's true. The path of totality, which is this narrow path about 100 miles wide and thousands of miles long, stretches all across the United States, but it passes through western Kentucky, including Paducah, for example, and Hopkinsville, and people in that path of totality, and only people in that path of totality, will see a total eclipse, and a total eclipse is an absolutely spectacular thing to see.
Mm. And so Lexington is not in that path of totality, right?
Lexington is not. That's right. Here in Lexington, the sun will be about 95% covered up at mid-eclipse, which will be around 2:30 in the afternoon on Monday. But that 5% of the sun still shining at mid-eclipse in Lexington will wash out the spectacular features of the total eclipse, visible only to those in the path of totality. But not everybody, of course, can get down to the path of totality in western Kentucky or Tennessee. So if you're here in Lexington, it's still something that's interesting to see, but we should talk about eye protection in that regard.
Absolutely. And I know there are a few events going on. I know the Arboretum, UK's Arboretum, is going to have an event, you know, to have people come down and watch what they can. But where do you think where's the geographically closest place that's in the path of totality to Lexington?
Probably somewhere in western Kentucky or in Tennessee. Hopkinsville may be among the closest. There's been a lot of talk about viewing the eclipse from Hopkinsville. Hopkinsville is, in fact, right along the center line of this path of totality where you see the total eclipse. And so Hopkinsville is a good place to observe the eclipse. But then again, there are a lot of other places all along the path of totality. Paducah, for example. Nashville is also in the path of totality. So a lot of places. Hopkinsville is an interesting place to see the eclipse, but it's by no means the only place where you can see it, yeah. weather permitting.
And so, Tom, you mentioned that you were heading to Nashville, right?
Yes.
So why would an astronomer go to Nashville rather than Hopkinsville to see it?
There's a simple reason for that. My wife was able to reserve a Airbnb
in
Nashville area and not in the Hopkinsville area.
Cool. Well, that's great. And obviously Nashville's a lot of fun as well. So
we will be joined by some family members and close French friends with whom we witnessed an eclipse in 1999 in France. So we have a whole eclipse delegation. We're not, except for me, astronomers, we're all fans of eclipses, and we all plan to have a good time. If we see the eclipse owing to good weather, then we're going to celebrate thereafter. And if we don't, we're going to not really celebrate, but we're going to have a good time nonetheless.
Yeah, well, that's good to hear. Anyway.
Right, right.
So how rare is this eclipse, Tom?
Well, it depends on what your travel budget is. If you have a travel budget so you can travel anywhere in the world, then you can see a total eclipse, weather permitting, almost once a year. But if you're more restricted in terms of your location, then eclipses are much rarer. The reason being that in order to see the total eclipse, you have to be in the path of totality. And the path of totality, although it's very wide, is quite narrow, only about 100 miles in width. And that path of totality only covers a very small part of the Earth. So the chances of seeing a given eclipse are small unless you're willing to travel to where the path of totality will be. Now, here in Kentucky, we have this eclipse coming up on Monday. It so happens, it's unusual, but it so happens that we also have another total solar eclipse with a similar path of totality in a little less than 7 years, on April 8th of 2024. That eclipse will also be seen as a total eclipse in western Kentucky, and the eclipse path will go north through Indianapolis and Cleveland and beyond. So we are actually quite favored, given eclipse statistics. We're actually quite favored in having two total eclipses visible within about 7 years from the same general part of the country, in particular including western Kentucky. Now, if you ask about what about Lexington, suppose you wanted to see a total eclipse in Lexington, well, the last one was in 1869, and the next total eclipse visible as a total eclipse in Lexington will be in 2153. Wow. So if you don't get out much and can't travel, then you're going to have to plan very far ahead.
Better start eating some kale. Make sure you're around for that. For
That's
sure.
Right. Oh, yes.
Wow. So what is it about the science or the rotation of the Earth and the Sun that puts Kentucky in that spot to put it here in the path of totality? What creates the path of totality?
Well, in order to have a total eclipse of the Sun, you have to have a situation where the Moon puts itself between the Sun and the Earth. Mm-hmm. So if the Moon is between the Sun and the Earth, then the Moon's shadow is cast upon the Earth. Mm-hmm. But the exact path across which that shadow of the Moon moves during the eclipse depends upon the exact position of the Sun with respect to the Moon and Earth. Mm-hmm. And so every eclipse has a somewhat different path of totality. So the path of totality, for example, of this eclipse goes from Oregon all the way across the United States and out to sea in South Carolina. Now, the eclipse coming up in 2024 has a different eclipse path. It will travel from Mexico up through Texas and ultimately western Kentucky and then up through, for example, Buffalo, New York and into Canada. So it has just a different trajectory. It all depends upon the relative positions of the Earth and the Moon and the Sun. Mm-hmm. In every case, it's different.
Yeah, well, that's fascinating, you know. You know, I wanted to ask you just a little bit about yourself, Tom. Where are you from?
I'm originally from Connecticut. I grew up in a little town called New London, Connecticut. Went to undergraduate school in Massachusetts, and then went to graduate school in astronomy out on the West Coast. So, cool. Since 1981, I've been at the University of Kentucky in the Department of Physics and Astronomy.
That's great. And what brought you to Lexington?
I mean, one word: a job.
Job. That's what it sounds like.
Well, in astronomy, it's not always easy to find jobs. There are more people with doctoral degrees in the field interested in doing research than there are positions. Mm-hmm. And when I was offered a faculty position, low those many years ago at the University of Kentucky, I thought to myself, that seems like a pretty good deal. And I've been here all that time since, and I've been very happy to be here in Lexington and to be part of the University of Kentucky.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people don't realize how interconnected not only the UK astronomy department is to space and to space study all around the world, but in particular, you know, the fact that there are astronauts working here in Kentucky, you know?
Well, we have some presence of people involved in human spaceflight in various parts of Kentucky, mm-hmm. and we also have astronomy departments at a number of the Kentucky universities, not necessarily astronomy departments, but physics departments that have astronomers, or physics and astronomy departments, all the same thing. Astronomy is part of physics, but the University of Kentucky has astronomers, of which I am one. Western Kentucky, for example, has a good program. Eastern Kentucky and Moorhead have programs in astronomy. So there's a lot of astronomy here in Kentucky.
Mm-hmm. A lot of stars, astronomy stars, if you will. Sorry, that's a terrible joke.
All my jokes are bad too, so don't feel bad about it.
So Tom, what initially got you interested in astronomy?
My father, he was a high school science teacher, mostly chemistry, but he had an interest in astronomy. Mm-hmm. And when I was a little kid, he helped to develop my interest in astronomy. Never forced the issue, but he got me interested and told me about things. And then I went to high school, the high school where he taught. And I already was very interested in astronomy. We'd already tried to see two eclipses without good weather. But when I got to high school, as a senior, my father offered a one-semester astronomy class, which I took. And forgive me for being a little bit immodest, I got an A in that class.
Yeah, teacher's pet.
Right. Then I went to undergraduate school and majored in astronomy and physics, and then to graduate school and began my career as a research astronomer.
Interesting. And what are you researching right now?
My research fundamentally is on the question of how it is that stars form. Mm. Those bright little points of light you see in the sky are large gaseous balls, just like the Sun. Some cases bigger, some cases smaller, but the question of how stars form and what they form from is one of the key questions in astronomy today. As I like to tell my students in astronomy class, the study of astronomy is not only a study of how things are now, but also, and perhaps even more importantly, how they got to be the way they are now. So we have all these stars. How did they form? And my research is directed towards trying to better understand how stars form.
Mm. Interesting. And so how do you think stars do form?
Well,
if you can break it down in layman's terms for us.
Well, stars form from raw materials, just like anything else. If you're going to make something, you got to start out with something to make it from. And the raw materials for star formation are molecules of and atoms of gas and particles of dust that lie in the space between the stars. People think of space as being a vacuum, but it's not exactly. It's close, but not exactly. Out in the space between the stars, there is a very thin medium of gas and dust. The gas is mostly hydrogen. And that very thin medium is the raw material from which new stars form. Over millions of years, these clouds of material between the stars gather themselves together, become hotter, and stars, and for that matter, planets form from them. So that's the basic process, but like all matters in science, there are a lot of details we don't understand, and one of the details that we don't understand very well about how stars form is what role does magnetism in space play? And my research more specifically deals with that particular question.
That's interesting. Do you have a favorite celestial body?
The Earth, yes.
The Earth. Well, why do you like that one?
When I go out to elementary schools, as I sometimes do, to give talks on astronomy, one of the common questions I ask is, what is your favorite planet? And students have various opinions, and it's interesting to hear what they say and what they think. And then I say, well, my favorite planet is the Earth, because there's air to breathe, there's food to eat, and all these things that make life worthwhile.
Yeah, that's awesome. And do any of the kids say Pluto? I know that's a little bit beyond their generation.
Some of them know about some Pluto, yes. Many of them, depending on the age group, by fourth grade, many of them know all the planets, even maybe a little bit earlier. And some of them even know that Pluto, as my wife likes to say, got kicked out of the Planets Club. She sometimes tells me, well, why did you people kick Pluto out of the Planets
Club? You're a dwarf star. Get out of here.
Get out, right? I tell her that Pluto doesn't give a darn what we think. It's just human beings coming up with various classifications. Yeah. Pluto is Pluto, independent of whether we call it this or that.
Yeah.
I tell her to chill out. Chill, baby, chill on that one.
So it's technically a dwarf planet is what they
refer to Pluto was officially classified now as a dwarf planet.
Now, what is the difference between a regular planet and a dwarf planet?
Well, fundamentally, as the name dwarf planet suggests, it's a much smaller than a regular planet. The smallest regular planet in the solar system is the planet Mercury, and Pluto is a lot smaller and a lot less massive than Mercury. So there really is a difference between the smallest regular planet, Mercury, and the largest of the dwarf planets. And now there are a number of other, a handful or so of dwarf planets that we also know that are comparable in size to Pluto and out there in the more distant parts of the solar system in most cases. So probably in 50 years, with advance of technology, we'll know maybe 100, maybe 1,000 dwarf planets.
Wow.
So I think one of the reasons why astronomers decided to kick Pluto out of the Planet Club is because they realized that if they didn't create this separate category, then in the end we'd have not just 8 or 9 planets for school kids to memorize, but 1,000. So what's the point of that?
Right. Yeah. Oh, yeah. There's enough within those 9 planets themselves that need to be explored and understood before we add any more.
Of course, also now in the last few decades, astronomers, not me specifically, but astronomers have developed techniques to discover planets orbiting around other stars. Mm-hmm. So as you look up in the sky at night and see all those points of light, as I was saying earlier, they are similar to the sun in the sense they're very large, hot balls of gas, some even hotter than the sun, some cooler. And we now know that many, and perhaps all, stars have their own planetary systems. And the planets may be closer to their host stars than our planets are further away, bigger or smaller. But it's amazing now, thousands of so-called exoplanets have been discovered by astronomers in the last few decades. So we are not alone in terms of planets. The question, of course, comes up, are any of those planets habitable? And some of them that have been discovered already seem to have the basic characteristics that might make them habitable.
Yeah.
However, we have absolutely no idea whether they are inhabited by anything.
Yeah, so like Kepler-23b.
Right.
You know, what do we know about Kepler that we know that it's similar to the Earth's
ecosystem? It's similar to the Earth in size and mass, and it is at the appropriate distance from its host star so that liquid water could exist. We think that one key requirement for life, any kind of life that we can imagine, and maybe there are kinds we can't, but one key requirement we think is liquid water, because the chemistry, the complex chemistry of life, takes place far more easily in liquid water than any other way, and that's why our bodies are so much liquid water, because that's where the chemistry takes place, in a liquid water environment. So a planet that might possibly host life would, we think, have to be a planet that had conditions suitable for liquid water. Not too far from the host star, which would make the liquid water, if any, freeze. Not too close, which would make the liquid water vaporize and become part of the atmosphere. Mm-hmm. But it has to be just in the right location, as, of course, the Earth is.
Yeah, that perfect equidistance.
Exactly.
Without a doubt. So I'm curious. So recently there was water found on the surface of Mars. Is that right?
There are indications that water exists in the surface of Mars. And moreover, there are indications that if you go back billions of years in time in the early solar system, there are indications that Mars was once flooded with water. There may even have been oceans on Mars. Wow. And the temperatures on the surface might have been much warmer than they are today. Mm-hmm. But even today, there are some indications of the presence of frozen water. And in fact, Mars has polar caps, and part of the polar caps are made up of frozen water. So we know there is water on Mars, but it's not liquid water. Mm. Because conditions today aren't suitable for liquid water. If you went to Mars, for example, and you brought with you a jug of water, liquid water, and you poured it out on the surface, well, within a short period of time, the water would either freeze solid or it would evaporate and become part of the atmosphere, depending on just what the temperature conditions were right wow. there. So it would not, in any case, remain as liquid water for more than a very short time.
So it would be like pouring water out in Rio de Janeiro versus Antarctica.
Right, exactly. Kind of. Yeah, it's one or the other, right. Yeah. In Rio, it just all steams up. In Antarctica, it all freezes up. Mm-hmm. That's exactly right.
Yeah, that's pretty fascinating. And I think particularly with, you know, the Planet Finder mission that's going on right now and just the current state of space exploration, I think there's a lot of really exciting things happening. Are there any things in particular that you're excited about as an astronomer?
Well, although it has no direct connection to my research, I've always been fascinated by planetary exploration. Mm-hmm. NASA and the European Space Agency have sent out into the solar system remote probes that have just returned incredible amounts of information, beautiful pictures and so forth. Landers on Mars, the orbiter, Cassini orbiter, has been orbiting now for more than a decade around Saturn, and which will meet its doom next month mm-hmm. because it will be deliberately shot into the atmosphere of Saturn and destroyed. You might ask why, and the answer is because it's reaching the end of its lifetime and its energy sources, and there is some fear that if it were just left in orbit around Saturn forever, it might crash into Europa, one of the satellites of Saturn, and we think that Europa might possibly be in a boat of life. We don't want to pollute that. We don't want to pollute that satellite of Saturn, possibly with a spacecraft from Earth crashing into it. So we are sacrificing Cassini, but in the last decade or more, Cassini has sent back to the Earth just absolutely stunning pictures of Saturn and its ring system and its satellites.
Yeah, they're studying.
That's exciting.
And they're studying what it makes up the rings, right? Or why the rings exist, what their composition is.
Right. Well, we'd like to know what the composition of the rings are. We'd like to understand better phenomena of the rings. The rings show these intricate wave patterns, for example, that apparently have to do with gravity among the various ring particles, and we'd like to better understand that. It turns out Saturn's not the only planet with a ring system. Jupiter, Saturn, and Uranus and Neptune, all four have ring systems, but only Saturn's ring system is really bright and obvious.
So is it just visibility, or...?
Well, the Saturn's ring system just contains a lot more particles. Mm-hmm. The ring system is made up of literally countless small particles, maybe the size of your fist, maybe smaller, maybe a bit larger. These particles are mostly chunks of ice of various sorts. Their origin is not fully understood, but there are just a lot of them, and they reflect light very well, and so they're very visible, even through a small telescope. We have, for example, a small telescope on the University of Kentucky campus, and the rings of Saturn through that telescope really are striking. But the rings of Jupiter and of Uranus and Neptune are made up of darker particles, and there are fewer of them, so they really can't be seen directly through a telescope.
So did we know that before we went out to Saturn to take those photos?
Well, the rings of Saturn have been known since the first telescopes 300 years or so ago, because the rings of Saturn are plainly visible mm-hmm. and even a small telescope.
Yeah, I guess I just wonder if we were sending a craft out there and, you know, we're thinking, oh, we can go past Jupiter, it'll be fine, and then you start to realize that there actually are, you know, fist-sized rings of ice out there. Was that a surprise, or was that something
we've
known for?
Well, the rings of Saturn weren't a surprise.
Of Jupiter, I guess.
Of Jupiter, sorry. Okay, I understand, yes. The rings of Jupiter, yes, were a surprise. They were discovered by one of the early spacecraft. I believe it was Pioneer 1 or Pioneer 2 or Voyager 1, Voyager 2, in the late 20th century, four spacecraft flybys were sent into the outer solar system, and all four of them passed by Jupiter and Saturn, and one of them passed by Uranus and Neptune. So it was there via those spacecraft that these other ring systems were discovered. And yes, they were a surprise. Not a dramatic surprise. Yeah. It's not unimaginable, but yeah. It was unknown before that time.
Awesome. Well, that's very cool to hear. And I wanted to, you know, just to get back a little bit about the eclipse, I wanted to ask you, you know, I've always heard that the moon is just a chunk of the Earth that was hit and knocked off a while ago. Is that true?
Well, the most likely scenario for the origin of the moon today is that, just as you say, there was a collision, a titanic collision in the early solar system. An object, we think roughly the size of the present planet Mars, struck the Earth and ripped a lot of the outer material of the Earth out into space. And that material then orbited around the Earth and eventually coagulated into an object. And that object is the moon today. So it seems most likely that the moon was formed by this collision. Very early in the history of the solar system, there was a lot more debris floating around than there is today. So there are a lot of collisions going on. And we think one collision most likely formed the moon.
Wow. And that's why we have the eclipse.
Before we get off the eclipse topic, I do have to make a comment about eye safety.
Sure,
that's very important.
Please, Doug.
If you were to go out on any day of the year that's sunny and look up at the sun and stare at the sun, you would damage your retina. Mm-hmm. Of course, on an ordinary day, a sunny day that is, you don't normally do that. You might conceivably take a momentary look at the sun, but generally you don't even do that, and even if you did, it won't hurt you. Mm-hmm. Now, on the day of an eclipse, it's not as if the sun suddenly becomes some giant monster in the sky out to ruin your eyesight, but on the day of an eclipse, there is a motivation to keep looking at the sun during the time that the sun gets more and more covered up by the moon and then less and less covered up after the eclipse. So there is what you might call an attractive nuisance. There's a reason to look up at the sun. So people who would ordinarily not look up at the sun on a regular sunny day will instead look up and then look up maybe 5 minutes later and look up 5 minutes later. Well, if you do that without proper eye protection, you will damage your retina and very likely permanently. So don't do that. If you wish to look at the sun directly, then it's important to have solar eclipse glasses. These are inexpensive cardboard glasses with a type of plastic that absorbs almost all of the light coming through them. These eclipse glasses are so dark that you see nothing through them except the disk of the sun. If you look around through your eclipse glasses at a sunny scene, you won't see a thing. Only if you look up at the sun, you'll see the disk of the sun. So those eclipse glasses are safe. And they are, I'm told, still available to some extent around here, but they're becoming somewhat more scarce. If you don't have eclipse glasses, then don't look at the sun if you wish to preserve your vision. But one thing you can see, even without eclipse glasses, is kind of neat. If you go outside on an ordinary day and see sunlight filtering through the leaves of a tree and creating spots on the ground, each of those spots is actually a small image of the sun. On an ordinary day, the sun's image is a circle. So you look at the light falling on, say, the pavement, filtering through the leaves of a tree on an ordinary day, you see a series of little spots. A lot of times they overlap, and they're not very good images, but they are images of the sun. Now, during a partial eclipse, when the sun is partly blocked by the sun, the sun's shape in the sky is no longer circular. And so those images that you see of sunlight filtering through the tree leaves and landing on the pavement no longer around. They're crescent-like. Oh. And that is a very interesting thing to see.
Yeah.
And you can look down at the ground, of course, all you like during the eclipse, and you won't damage your eyes. For that matter, during the eclipse, you can look around at the landscape just as much as you would on any other day.
For sure, yeah.
Just don't look at the sun.
Just don't stare at the sun like you would on any other normal day.
Exactly. Don't do anything you wouldn't do on an ordinary day unless you have the eclipse glasses. And I was told that there are still some available around town. I'm not sure exactly where.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I'm always fascinated by what people thought of the eclipse before modern science knew what it was, but also the effects on wildlife, of especially, you know, nocturnal animals and being confused by the darkness of the eclipse. Do you hear a lot about that happening?
Well, I've witnessed two total solar eclipses. I've tried to see five. I've only seen two under conditions of good weather. Mm-hmm. But I can tell you that in both cases, there certainly were sounds of animals who were confused. A perfectly good sunny day during the total eclipse becomes about as dark as the night of the full moon. Because during the total eclipse, the sun is about as bright as the full moon when the sun's disk, that is completely covered in a total eclipse. And then what you see is the outer atmosphere of the sun called the corona, which is a beautiful thing to see, stunning thing to see, an irregularly shaped pearly white region around the sun that is only visible during a total solar eclipse, but it's only about as bright as the full moon. So as far as the animals are concerned, it's basically gotten dark. So they birds make noises, and farm animals, if there are any in the area, behave in ways that suggest they think it's about time to go nighty-night.
Yeah.
Now, human beings, of course, today we understand what causes eclipses, but I can only imagine centuries and especially millennia ago in ancient times, most people didn't understand what caused eclipses, so you can only imagine the concern you might have if you were out on a nice sunny day and suddenly, well, not suddenly, but over a period of an hour or two, things got darker, and then at a certain point, the sun was completely blocked out. You might be concerned that perhaps some vengeance of the gods was about to be perpetrated on you.
Well, I would imagine, too, if you're an astronomer and you have that information and know to expect it, that, you know, maybe you could use that to incite some excitement.
Right, exactly.
Or your will, you know, whatever.
Well, it's interesting, if you go back in time, I'm not a historian of science, but my understanding is that even in ancient times, people who were learned did understand what caused eclipses. They understood that it was the moon that got between the sun and the earth, and they even found certain cycles of eclipses that occurred at periodic times, so they could, to some extent, predict eclipses. So some understanding of eclipses was certainly known to the ancients, but only to people who were knowledgeable about such matters. And most people, I'm sure, in ancient times, and even far later than that, really didn't understand what was going on, so they would have been quite surprised by a total solar eclipse.
Of like, what? This is not supposed to happen already?
No, that's not supposed to happen.
Well, that's amazing. So maybe let's take a quick break and we come back, and I'd like to talk a little bit more about the sun, because I think it's fascinating, and I don't know, is the reason that we all exist. So nonetheless, you're listening to WLXU 93.9, and we're Bluegrass Bios, and we'll be back here in a little bit. And move that in my direction. Thankful for that, it's such a blessing, yeah. Turn every situation into heaven, yeah.
Hello, this is Lisette Reyes from Nicaragua, which I'm a professional dancer with 23 years of experience. I'm going to be here this 26th of August for Zumbatón El Pulso Latino 95.7 FM, supporting this great cause for El Pulso Latino 95.7 FM, along with some other great Zumba instructors supporting this great cause, and that is going to be happening from 4 to 6 p.m. on August 26th. At West 6 Brewing, 501 West 6th Street, Lexington, Kentucky. Again, 501 West 6th Street, Lexington, Kentucky. Please don't miss this wonderful day. Please put it in your calendar. We're gonna be there providing some awesome rhythms, Latin rhythms like salsa, merengue, reggaeton, samba, and more. I'll see you there.
Before you ride, do your ABC quick check. Make sure you have enough air in your tires, brakes are working, chain is running smoothly, and quick release levers are closed. Also, remember that bike maintenance is important, and having required lights and visible clothing at night is vital to riding safely. This message is brought to you in partnership by Lexington Community Radio and Bluegrass Cycling Club.
Are you a musician in or around Lexington? Are you interested in submitting your music for WLXU's local music show that airs on Sundays from 6 a.m. to 8 a.m.? If you are, then contact Mary Clark by going to www.lexingtoncommunityradio.org and clicking on the Submit Your Music tab. Thanks for listening to Lexington Community Radio and for supporting our local music scene. Dig smart. Stay safe. Call 811 before you dig. It's the law. This public service will show you exactly where it's safe to dig. Call between 2 and 10 business days before work begins. Visit ColumbiaGasKY.com for more information.
Will
you be needing a haircut soon? Anyone can go to Brenda's Estetica on 1533 Eastland Parkway, number 11. This is a unisex, family-friendly establishment that does haircuts, perms, colors, extensions, and more. You can learn more about Brenda's Estetica by visiting their Facebook page, Brenda's Estetica Unisex, or by calling 859-757-1355. Again, that's Brenda's Estetica on 1533 Eastland Parkway, number 11, at 859-757-1355. Lexington Community Radio thanks Brenda's Estetica for supporting True Community Radio.
Live every Wednesday from 6 to 7 p.m., it's Joey Truax. The best part, it's the best part. It's Hip Hop 101, you know what I'm saying, with your boy Joey Truax, live every Wednesday from 6 to 7 p.m. You are tuned into the best part. It's where we go through all the classic flavor, you know what I'm saying? Interviews, celebrities, local artists, the whole nine, you know what I'm saying? So tune in. You are tuned into the best part. That's Wednesdays from 6 to 7 p.m., all right? Peace.
WLXU, supported by the Lexington Fayette County Health Department. The Health Department is a recognized leader in health promotion, health protection, personal health care, and the prevention of disease. They're located at 650 Newtown Pike and can be reached by phone at 859-252-2371. For more information, visit their website, lexingtonhealthdepartment.org.
This is Luke Cage. No, I'm kidding. This is Frank X. Walker from the Appalachian Poets, and you're listening to WLXU 93.9 LPFM, Lexington Community Radio.
1960 what? Hey, everybody, and we're back. You're listening to Bluegrass Bios here on 93.9 WLXU up here on the north side of Lexington, Kentucky, coming to you live and sort of hot from the north side, from 6th Street. My name is Chuck, and with us in the studio is Tom Trolin, UK astronomy professor, and we're talking about the eclipse. So I'm curious, Tom, what are some misconceptions that you hear about the eclipse all the time?
One misconception, I think, is this idea that somehow the sun is more dangerous on an eclipse day than it is on any other day. That is to say, people sometimes think, as I may have mentioned earlier, sometimes think that the sun is sending out some kind of dangerous rays or something on an eclipse day that it's not sending out on other days. And in fact, the sun doesn't know anything about these eclipses, doesn't care anything about these
yeah,
eclipses.
It's pretty ambivalent, yeah.
The sun is exactly the same during an eclipse as it is any other time. But people have been told, and rightfully so, about the dangers of looking at the eclipse. But the dangers of looking at the eclipse, as I mentioned, are no greater than the dangers of staring at the sun on any ordinary sunlit day. And so, for example, here in Lexington, where around 2:30 in the afternoon, the eclipse will be maximum, the sun will be 95% covered by the moon. Even that remaining 5% of light from the sun that's not covered in Lexington, even that is dangerous to your eyes. Mm-hmm. So if you stare at that without proper eye protection, then you'll damage your retina. So I think people are aware of the dangers, and it's very important that we tell them about that, but I think sometimes people become over-aware. They think that the sun is just out to get them on eclipse day.
Yeah.
Another thing I think which people oftentimes think is that it's not safe to look at the sun during the total eclipse. Hmm. Now, if you are in the path of totality, if you are in the right position at the right time to witness the total eclipse, that is to say when the disk of the sun is 100% covered up, something that will only happen at any given location for 2.5 minutes, mm-hmm. during that time of the total eclipse, then you're free to look at the eclipse without any eye protection. Sometimes people don't know that. They think, well, gee, I better keep my eclipse glasses on. Well,
yeah.
If you keep your eclipse glasses on during the total eclipse, you'll see absolutely nothing.
Yeah. It's like closing your eyes.
You might as well just close your eyes and go to sleep. So during the total eclipse, if you are in the eclipse zone, and Lexington, of course, is not, it is perfectly safe to look directly at the sun and witness that event. And I tell people, I strongly recommend that if you are so lucky as to be in the total eclipse zone and the weather's good, I strongly recommend that you spend most of those precious two and a half minutes looking around with your eyes. Don't spend the time, at least this is my opinion, don't spend that time fiddling with a camera or looking through a camera viewfinder or something to get that picture, because the experience, the human sensory experience of seeing a total eclipse is really, in my view, the most important part of it. That's why I go. I don't go for astronomy, although I am, of course, an astronomer and I'm interested in astronomy. I go just for that sensory experience of seeing a total eclipse. And if you spend your whole time during the two and a half minutes just looking through a piece of equipment of some sort, like a camera viewfinder, you won't experience that sensation. I say let other people take the pictures, and you can download those off the internet as much as you like immediately after the eclipse. What I think people should do is just drink in that sensory experience of seeing the eclipse, because it is a phenomenon unlike anything else you'll ever see.
It's like going to the Redwood Forest. You're never going to photograph it all.
That's very true.
Just take it in.
Also, pictures, for various reasons, pictures of the eclipse simply don't reproduce the visual experience that you have if you just look up there with your own two eyes. That's all it takes during the total eclipse. If you're in that path of totality, you just take off those glasses, look up into the sky, and you will see a dark circle, which is the silhouette of the moon covering the entire disk of the sun. And all around that dark circle, you will see the outer atmosphere of the sun, the corona, which is pearly white and irregular in shape and extends quite some distance from around the sun. It's a very interesting part of the sun's outer atmosphere, but you can never see it on an ordinary day because the corona is a million times fainter than the disk of the sun. Mm-hmm. So only during an eclipse, when the sun's disk is completely covered, only then do you see the corona, and it is a very, very beautiful sight.
Wow, that's amazing. And, you know, let's talk a little bit about the sun. You know, what do we know about the sun? How did it originate? And I know, how old is it? You know, is it different than any other, you know, star in a different galaxy?
Well, the sun is, by most standards, a typical star. Mm-hmm. Some stars in our galaxy, those points of light you see in the nighttime sky, or stars in other galaxies, some stars are bigger than the sun, some are smaller, some are hotter, some are cooler, some emit more light energy every second, some emit less. So there's a range of properties for stars, but in many ways the sun is kind of an ordinary star. Mm-hmm. In the same way I tell myself, well, the house in which I live in is fairly ordinary house, but it's my house, so it's special for that reason. Now, the sun, we think, is about 4.5 billion years old. Mm-hmm. It's impossible to visualize or imagine just how long a period of time that is. Mm-hmm. 1,000 years is a long time in human civilization.
Now imagine, even just 2017 is a long time.
Already, some people say that 2017 has been dragging along quite slowly.
I
hear you. But 1,000 years is a long time. 1,000 thousands is, of course, a million. Mm-hmm. That's a really long time. And 1,000 millions is a billion. So 1 billion years is a really long time, but that's still not how long the sun has been around. We think the sun has been around, and all of the planets of the solar system and their satellites are about 4.5 billion years. Mm-hmm. And we think that the whole solar system came into existence from a giant cloud of originally cold gas and dust in our galaxy that fell together under its own gravity, under its own weight, heated up, and towards the center the sun formed, and then a swirling disk developed around this forming sun, and in that swirling disk material got together and formed the planets. Mm. That's why the planets today all have orbits that are nearly circular and all about on the same plane. You can almost lay out a three-dimensional a map of the solar system on a flat table. Not quite, but pretty close. So 4.5 billion years ago, the sun formed. Temperatures got hot enough deep inside the sun for what we call nuclear reactions to begin. And those reactions generate huge amounts of energy. And they've been powering the sun for that time since, the last 4.5 billion years. And we think the sun will probably be good for 4, 5, maybe 6 more billion years before it finally runs out of energy, and that'll be it. But that's, even that's something that will happen slowly.
Yeah, probably it will unlikely, or most likely outlive humanity, no doubt about that.
Well, humanity will have fleed the Earth, no doubt, by that time, because even long before the sun reaches really old age, it's kind of middle-aged star now, but long before it reaches old age, perhaps in only a billion years, the sun's energy output will have grown by a little bit, not too much, but by a little bit, and we think that will be enough in about 1 billion years to destroy the climate of the Earth. So human beings will have had to vacate the Earth by that time and gone somewhere else. And then looking further ahead in time, eventually billions of years from now, 5, 6, 7 billion years from now, the sun will run out of energy, and we think it eventually becomes something called a white dwarf, a tiny little nugget of a star, only 1/100th as big across as the sun is today, and with no further source of energy, so it just cools off like a hot potato you take from the oven, and the white dwarf sun will eventually become fainter and fainter, and eventually it'll emit no more light, and that's it.
Just be a dormant.
Just be a dormant object in space, and there are no doubt lots of such dormant objects in our galaxy, because lots of stars have been born and have died in our galaxy since the beginning of the universe, and more stars are being formed today. It's kind of like the human population. A lot of people have been born and no longer are alive, and new people are being born, living out their lifetimes. Some people young today, some people middle-aged, some people a little bit older, like myself. So the stellar population is, in that sense, a bit like the human population. Mm-hmm. A range of ages formed at different times.
True, cyclical by nature.
Yes, yes.
Absolutely. And please go ahead.
Speaking of cyclical, that brings up the term recycling. We are, as human beings, partly the beneficiary of recycled material for stars, because you see, when some stars end their lifetimes, they end their lifetimes explosively, and the chemical elements that they have formed inside their lifetimes during their energy generating phases, those chemical elements get blown out into space, and eventually some of that material comes together to form new stars and planets. So the chemical elements that are most important for life, like carbon and nitrogen and oxygen and so forth, iron, calcium, all these chemical elements were formed in previous generations of stars that lived and died even longer than 4.5 billion years ago when the solar system formed. So the whole solar system, including the Earth and including our bodies, is formed in part from recycled material. And if it were not for that recycled material, like carbon and nitrogen and oxygen, needless to say, life would not be possible on Earth. So we really are children of the stars.
Very true. And, you know, I think and if somebody's out there drinking a glass of water today, likely that water may have gone through a brontosaurus.
Yeah,
you know?
That's
also gone through
likely.
A trilobite. Who knows?
That's right. That's right. And it got cleaned up since that time.
Yeah, the limestone cleaned it. So
that's always
thank
good.
You for those ancient sea creatures.
Right, right. Exactly. It's interesting. You know, astrology is a magical system of beliefs that people can believe in if they wish. I don't, but I don't see any sense in it, but it's certainly harmless. Astrology developed as an attempt on the part of human beings to seek a connection between what's up there in space and what's down here. But the thing I like to tell my students in my introductory astronomy classes is that we really are connected to the stars. There is a real connection. Astrology is a made-up series of beliefs, in my opinion. But there really is a connection between us and the stars. It's not quite so direct. It is that connection, as I mentioned earlier, that we are made up in part of recycled material that came from previous generations of stars. So we really are children of the stars. There is a connection between us down here and stuff that existed up there in the past. That's the real connection. Astrology is, I believe, a made-up connection. So in ancient times, they looked for that connection. They found it, and they called it astrology. In modern times, astronomers have looked for that connection. They found it, and they call it cosmic recycling or by other different terms, but that's ultimately what it is. So we are from the stars.
Well, it's fascinating, you know, and I wanted to ask you, you know, I always think about this, and I would encourage anyone listening that you can go to YouTube and check out Powers of 10, as we were talking about, to really see the scale of our atomic levels and neutrons, going from that all the way to the outer limits of our galaxy. It does a fascinating job, I think, of showing the scale of where we're at in human existence. So if we leave our galaxy, if we leave the Milky Way, and we start to travel beyond Pluto and just keep going and going and going, what happens? What's out there?
Well, the most honest answer to what's out there is not very much.
Yeah.
There's a lot of space. Let me give you an analogy. This is one I use in my astronomy classes at the University of Kentucky. If you imagine everything in the universe is scaled down to a point where the sun is the size of a ping pong ball, then the Earth would be a tiny little speck of dust about 12 feet away orbiting around that ping pong ball. And Neptune, which is the most distant major planet, would be about 500 feet away, a little bit bigger speck than the Earth. So the sun again is a ping pong ball. Neptune is 500 feet away. And that, in some sense, defines the outer edge of the solar system. Not exactly, because there's a lot of stuff even beyond that. But anyway, consider the solar system out to Neptune. You have the sun as a ping pong ball. Neptune's 500 feet away. So now you can ask, how far away on that scale is the next ping pong ball? Mm-hmm. That is to say, the next star. And the answer to that question is, if the sun is a ping pong ball and Neptune is 500 feet away across the field, let's say, depending on where you are, the nearest neighbor star to the sun, the nearest one, is 700 miles away. So you would put that, in, say, in Miami, Florida. Wow. So, and that's not unusual among the stars in the sky. If you go out and look up in the nighttime sky, all the stars you see are part of our Milky Way galaxy. Mm-hmm. And those stars are very far apart from each other. They're like ping pong balls separated by hundreds and hundreds of miles. So there is a huge amount of space in our galaxy between the stars. And other galaxies are like our galaxy, made up of zillions of stars, more literally perhaps billions or hundreds of billions. Other galaxies is the same way. Mm-hmm. You have stars and a huge amount of space between the stars. But it's in that space that there's this thin medium of gas and dust, and that's the stuff that comes together to form yet more stars. That's the raw material from which new stars form. So if you were in a spacecraft moving out away from our solar system, just within our galaxy, you would have to steer very carefully to get near to another star, because it's mostly just empty space.
Wow. And so if we wanted to send a craft out there, you know, it might be difficult because we would have no solar power to power it that way. You know, so we would have to figure out a system to travel that 700 miles, as you said, the way to the next galaxy. So right now we're pretty much limited to telescopes.
Just a correction there. That would be just to the nearest star in our galaxy.
Oh, I see.
Because our galaxy is a system of hundreds of billions of stars, and the 700 miles in the scale model where the sun is the size of a ping pong ball, 700 miles is to the nearest star.
Wow.
The nearest star.
So if we wanted to go to Kepler-23b, if we needed to, you know, millions and millions of years, and humanity had in a last-ditch effort to continue our existence, wanted to go to Kepler-23b, what would that look like?
Well, to get there, it would take many tens of thousands of years. So this would not be a journey that one generation of human beings could undertake, mm-hmm. barring, of course, some rather major medical advances that yeah. might extend human lifetime that long. I don't know whether we'll ever do that, of course, mm-hmm. and my sense is we won't, because there won't ever be enough of a motivation to do something so difficult as that. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, if you go back a few hundred years, there are all kinds of things that we know of today that people couldn't have imagined. Imagine, for example, traveling across the Atlantic Ocean in 6 or 8 hours on a jet airplane. Yeah. That's not something that someone in the 1700s could even have imagined. Right. So there may be things that I can't imagine. There are things that mm-hmm. I can and no one else can imagine today that could happen in the future. But it certainly appears as though interstellar travel is a remarkably difficult thing to do, and it would require people willing to commit to multiple generations on a journey.
And time itself changes, right, the further out you go. And I think that's something that people don't think about. So if you went way far out, you know, 3 days on Earth might be, you know, 15 minutes.
Well, that effect that you mentioned is called time dilation. It's a prediction of Einstein's theory of relativity. And it only applies, it turns out, in situations where you're moving at a substantial fraction of the speed of light. Mm. Now, the speed of light is the fastest thing we know. Light is so fast that it could travel around the Earth 7 times in a second if you could make it travel in a curved path. So that's pretty fast. According to the theory of relativity, no material object can actually even travel at that speed, but you can travel up to and close to it. Mm-hmm. So if an object is traveling, or a spaceship is traveling at, say, half the speed of light, then yes, the way in which time unfolds on that spacecraft will be different from the way in which time unfolds back here on Earth. Mm-hmm. And that is a prediction of the theory of relativity that has been verified by experimental means, although not actually by sending spacecraft out into space. There are ways in the laboratory you can look into this as well, and it's true.
Wow. Well, that's amazing. And, you know, we're just children of stars.
Yes.
Trying to travel as fast as a photon.
We are children of stars.
It's amazing. Well, Tom, thank you so much for coming in. You know, this has been such a fascinating conversation, and, you know, I'm looking forward to checking out the eclipse, and thank you for letting us know all about that.
Great pleasure to be here, and I hope as many people as possible see the eclipse safely, and if those who can get down to the path of totality and see a total eclipse, if the weather's good, I can guarantee you it'll be an experience you never forget. Thanks so much.
That's amazing. Thank you. And Professor Tom Trollin in the UK Department of Astronomy in here telling us about the eclipse, which is happening this Monday. So nonetheless, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be back here in a little bit. You're listening to Bluegrass Bios here on 93.9 WLXU LPFM, Lexington Community Radio.